Good afternoon. I thought I'd start with a short reflection on following on what we were exploring this morning. The conditionality, seeing the conditionality is kind of starting to point us to a deeper nature of our experience. Not the specific characteristics of our experience, but the more, we could call them the Dharma understandings that can happen around our experience. The conditioned nature points us to the impermanent flux nature of our experience. Because of that flux, the unreliability, the dukkha nature, unreliable as a place, there's no experience that's reliable as a place to land for lasting happiness. And the not-self nature of experience. There's no, what we tend to call self isn't what we think it is. This is the piece I wanted to just reflect on a little bit, the not-self aspect of understanding that can free the mind, the whole perspective of I, me, mine is one that generates a lot of suffering. And that perspective of self, it's like second nature for us, you know, it seems so intuitive. The sense that I am. We don't question that intuitive sense very much. I certainly never questioned it until I met these teachings. And yet, as we begin to observe our experience, there's a lot of experience that arises that is actually direct evidence for the truth of not-self. About the only evidence we have for self is the sense or the feeling that it's there, that it's... When we try to find the self, we can't really find it. But still, we take this very intuitive kind of sense as being evidence or the truth, even though we can't really find it. And yet, as we start to look at our experience and see the nature of our experience as impermanent and conditioned. We see the conditioned nature of our experience. We see that choices arise in the mind, and the mind processes those, responds to those, acts out of those. And it can be kind of startling to see who made that decision. That just happened. And so we begin to see that what we call self isn't exactly valid. And in one of the suttas, the sutta on the characteristic of not self, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Buddha actually pointed to what we could call the uncontrollability of these processes at work. He did it as kind of a dialogue. He asked his followers to reflect on each of the aggregates, reflect on form. And he says, form is not self. If form were self, this physical process, this physicality, this process of body, if this process were self, he says, it would be possible to determine of the body. Let my body be thus. Let my body not be thus. Essentially pointing to if there were a self, that self would have agency or control over what is self. That's actually an intuitive definition of self. What we call self, we think we should have control over. And herein lies a lot of the suffering around self, that we see that we don't have control over a lot of our experience. And we struggle with that. We feel like either we should have control over it, I'm failing somehow if I don't have control, or it's somebody else's fault. Somebody else is getting in the way of having that control. As opposed to understanding or taking this experience of uncontrollability as a pointer to what it is that the thing that is not controllable is not self. The experience. The Buddha continues, because form is not self, body leads to affliction. It is not possible to say, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. He says this too about feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. We could bring in mental formation. Let's bring in mindfulness here. Substitute mindfulness in this paragraph where the Buddha talks about mental formations are not self. Mindfulness is a mental formation. Mindfulness is not self. If mindfulness were self, it would be possible to determine if mindfulness, may my mindfulness be thus, may my mindfulness not be thus. This belief that we should be able to choose mindfulness when we want to leads to affliction. As the Buddha points out, if mindfulness were self, mindfulness would not lend itself to affliction. And it would be possible to determine if mindfulness, let my mindfulness be thus, let my mindfulness not be thus. So this uncontrollable nature of our experience, when we run into this uncontrollability, a sense of, why can't I make this be the way I want it to be? That experience of uncontrollability is a pointer to the truth of not self. And so perhaps in seeing uncontrollability, we could bring in that reflection, that wisdom reflection the Buddha encourages us to reflect. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not mine. This is not myself. This is not who I am. That he actually brings that phrase in quite a bit and encourages us to use that. I take that to be a kind of a use of wisdom reflection in the Buddhist teachings, using thoughts of wisdom to support us. And so this is a kind of time when we see this conditioned nature of experience and the kind of uncontrollability that is happening. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. It's evidence for not self. It's a pointer to that truth, that understanding. So there was a question that about concentration in this practice and the kind of one-pointed concentration. What are the advantages or differences between concentration achieved with open awareness versus single-pointed jhana-type meditation? This kind of came up almost indirectly this morning in one of the groups. So I talked about it a little bit there, but I haven't really spoken about this that much in the larger group. So I'll just see what kind of bubbles up in terms of thoughts about this particular topic right now. So the one-pointed concentration that develops with coming back to a single object over and over again, the experience in that state tends to be much more quiet. It's like the cultivation of that kind of mindfulness or that kind of concentration. We're stabilizing our mind on a particular experience. The breath, for example. And so not only does the awareness get very stable, but the object gets very stable. And so the experience of that can be very, very still. The stillness of both the awareness and the object of awareness. In the jhana-type meditation, the mind ultimately absorbs into a concept. Concept. It stabilizes a concept, and that concept is like it's like the concentration. The jhana like holds this concept in the mind, and that concept just becomes very, very still. So the kind of quality in the mind there is stillness. The jhanas themselves, the absorbed jhanas that are described in the Visuddhimagga anyway, the mind is in that place of kind of stabilizing experience on a concept, and so there's not a lot of appearance of change. And so that state, when there's not change, is not a place where the Vipassana insights will arise in the absorption. On the other hand, with the practice of that kind of concentration, the cultivation of that state itself, there's a lot of understanding, learning, wisdom that can develop as the mind moves in the direction of that absorption. There's a lot of understanding about what gets in the way, where the mind is clinging, what it's holding on to. There's a lot of letting go that happens around things that are not so useful for the construction of that state. So there's a lot of learning that happens in the going in. And also, as the mind lets go of that state, it's in a place where it's very clear, the mindfulness is quite strong, and as the state itself begins to fall apart, as the mind lets go of the concept and it starts to experience change again, the insight can be developed as the mind leaves that state. And so the state itself is not conducive to insight, the practice is very conducive to insight. The practice of learning to go in and the coming out. There's a lot of deep understandings that can happen around the cultivation of that state. Most of the, or at least for me, a lot of the learnings that tend to happen tend to be pretty subtle. That's not completely true, because at the beginning, in learning the state of concentration, there's an awful lot of greed, a lot of aversion, the mind like battling with its unpleasant body sensations and things that we learn how to let go of. And so there's that kind of practice at the beginning with the concentration practice. But there's a large terrain around that this concentration practice doesn't necessarily address in terms of learning. In many ways, I feel like the open awareness practice, the receptive awareness practice, is much broader in terms of what it lets in terms of experience and where it's just where it's willing to go. It's basically willing to meet whatever arises. It doesn't set anything aside. It's this, okay, this is what I get to pay attention to right now. And so in the open awareness practice, I'd say I started with the jhana practice talking about the state itself, the state being very still, because the object gets stabilized, the object of concentration gets stabilized, and so the mind moves to more and more stillness in that way. In the open awareness practice, the concentration, and in both cases I think we can say the concentration is a stability of mindfulness. That's an essential definition of concentration. When mindfulness stabilizes moment after moment, the mind is not pulled out into reactivity. And the definition of concentration being absent the hindrances. No kind of reactivity to what's arising in the moment. In the jhana-like practice, that reactivity tends to fall away because we're consciously letting go of anything, not the breath, or not whatever the object is that we're attending to stabilize on. in the moment-to-moment practice, the mindfulness, the continuity of mindfulness begins to support just a being willing to meet the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And in that stability, there's not as much room for the mind to react to something or think about it. And so the in the open awareness practice, the awareness or the mindfulness gets very stable and still. Kind of a still awareness, just meeting the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. But the experience may not be very still. The experience can be a moment of hearing and a moment of body sensation and a moment of a thought arising that's seen and the next moment of an emotion and the next moment another body sensation and a sound and a sight. It's not got that stability or the quietude of experience that the concentration practice has in the absorption itself. It may not have, because what I have seen is that with this open awareness practice, it really, it can depend on what's happening. Like, you know, if I'm doing open awareness practice in my house and they're doing construction next door, there's going to be sound coming in. And the mind will just be knowing that. And at first there's probably going to be some reactivity, but over time the reactivity will begin to fall away. And then there's the stability of the awareness, just taking in sometimes the sound, sometimes body sensations, sometimes states of mind, the mind experiencing, kind of moving more towards the experience of the calm, perhaps. And so if I'm in a situation where there's a lot of activity, the experience of open awareness can be one of a lot of change happening. And this is one of the big differences in the concentration. The concentration of the open awareness is meeting change. It's kind of, that's how it's mostly been cultivated, is through knowing moment after moment the changing experience. And this meeting of change is where insight and understanding will arise. And yet, I have seen. I mean, it was quite interesting. At one point, I was at the Forest Refuge for about 3 months, and I was doing kind of a combination of. Oh no, in this retreat I was doing open awareness practice entirely. I had done some concentration retreats at the Forest Refuge earlier, but this time I decided to just go and start with open awareness and just see what happened. And what I discovered in that case, there was a 3-day stretch where the heater basically blew out. And the heat was through a water system. It used radiant heat. It used water pumped through the building. And when the boiler blew out, the kind of hum of the water going through the building stopped. It was quite stunning just how quiet the Forest Refuge got without that kind of just subtle sound that was just kind of pervading everything. And when that happened, the open awareness practice led to what seemed much closer. I don't know if it was true absorption, but it felt like the open awareness practice could lead in that direction. The mind got very, very still. Very still. There just wasn't a lot of changing objects around. And I think with the open awareness, I have seen with open awareness that it can be a doorway into a very settled kind of concentration practice. And actually at this point, this kind of practice is my prelude to concentration practice. It stabilizes the mind to the point where it can, it sometimes will choose to pick up an object and stabilize on it and absorb into it. So we don't actually have to think about these two practices as somehow either one or the other. I've definitely experienced and yet we can talk about them as separate kinds of concentration. The absorption concentration is one kind of concentration. The moment-to-moment concentration is another kind of concentration. And generally, the focused practice may be aimed in the direction of the absorption concentration, and the open awareness practice may be aimed at the moment-to-moment concentration. But the absorption practice can lead and end up being in what's called access concentration, which is a concentration that's aware of changing experience. We can settle with the breath, aim the attention right to the breath, and be curious about the way the breath changes. That's a kind of a moment-to-moment concentration in a focused practice. We can, with open awareness, we can start with just receiving what's here, what's here, what's here. And in my case with the forest refuge, I think the stillness of the sound and the stillness of the mind kind of became the object, and then the mind kind of absorbing into that. And so I think we can distinguish between the states of concentration and the practices that tend to lead in the direction of particular kinds of concentration. And yet, in my own practice, I've seen that the focused practice of paying attention to the breath can lead to a moment-to-moment concentration, and the open awareness practice can lead to a kind of absorption concentration. So those practices, while maybe kind of aiming towards their particular flavor of concentration state, we don't have to think about them as only heading in that direction. At least in my own experience, I've had experiences that point out to me that that's not the case. So let's see if there's anything else to say with that. I guess the other piece to just point to is the value that I've seen in cultivating or kind of seeing the fluidity and the flexibility of the practices in support of different kinds of concentration. A kind of an appreciation for how the learning about different styles of practice supports the mind in different ways. Like I had spent quite a bit of time with the Mahasi practice, and then I went off and I learned the Tejaniya style practice, and then I went back to a concentration practice, a breath meditation practice. And in that returning to concentration practice following having explored the open awareness practice, I found that the tools that I had learned around relaxing and receiving could be applied to a more focused object. So attune to the breath and then receive it. And that was a revelation. It was a much more relaxed kind of approach, not trying to kind of dive out and like track and follow every moment of the breath, but settle back, what if the breath wants to show itself to me? And so I've seen the value of allowing, and what I guess I've seen the value of learning the various tools and then kind of trusting or exploring how do these various practices come together in our own minds, in our own way that our practice works. I was kind of surprised to see, and at some point in that concentration retreat that followed learning the open awareness style, I found out that I said that I discovered that the open awareness was my way in. That's when I discovered that I shouldn't start by trying to be with the breath. I should start by just like, oh, okay, let's just meet what's here. Oh, yep, here's the next thing. Oh, there's a breath. Wow, that was a really easy breath. How about another one? And then another one. And then finding the mind begin to constrict down and try to hold on to the breath. It's like, okay, just relax, go back. Go back to open awareness. The open awareness was starting to show me that I could be aware of the breath in a really relaxed way. But this was my own journey in exploring these different styles of practice. And what I would just like to suggest is that each of you might have your own kind of exploration in seeing how the practices support each other. I don't think we have to think about them as being, either I do this or I do this. In my own practice, I found them kind of interweaving and supporting each other.